Hello and welcome to the Machine Ethics Podcast. In episode 87, we're talking to Drs. Eleanor Drage and Kerry McInerney, both from the Good Robot Podcast. This episode was recorded on the 11th of March, 2024. We chat about the Good Robot Podcast, what is good technology, and is it even possible? The importance of joy and magic in technology, technology as being inherently political, the value of human creativity, how feminism, Aboriginal and mixed race studies can help in AI development, and the performative nature of technology. As always, if you like this episode, you can find more at machine-ethics.net. You can also contact us at hello@machine-ethics.net. You can follow us on Twitter, machine_ethics, Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube, youtube.com/@machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine ethics. Thanks again and hope you enjoy. Hi guys, thanks for coming on the podcast. If you could just introduce yourselves, who you are and what do you do? Kerry, you can start.
Sure, I'm Dr. Kerry McInerney. I'm a research fellow at the Leverhulme Centre for the Future of Intelligence, where I co-chair a project called The Global Politics of AI, which looks at how AI development is impacting international relations. But I'm also a science communicator, and I do quite a lot of work as an AIHRC, BBC, Radio 3 New Generation thinker, bringing my work on feminist and anti-racist approaches to AI to wide audiences. And I'm really delighted to be on the show.
Sweet, thank you. And Eleanor?
Kerry's introductions are always really professional, and I always feel like I'm trying to, you know, remember the things that I do sequentially. So I'll give it a go. I'm a senior research fellow also at the Leverhulme Centre for the Future of Intelligence, and I specialise in applying feminist and anti-racist ideas to making AI better and safer for everyone. And I have the great joy of working with Kerry, my work wife, on a number of projects, one of which is The Good Robot, the podcast that we have, and we've got this new book out together. And then I also do a number of a bit more practical projects, which is quite unusual for researchers. I think both of us are told a lot in our center, you know, we need to do things that really mean something to the world, whether that's giving the BBC a statistic on just how unrepresented women are in science fiction, and it's much more unrepresented than in real life as AI engineers, or whether it's applying feminist and anti-racist ideas to making the EU AI Act, this enormous bit of legislation, more impactful, so that when companies are self-auditing, so that they can meet the EU's obligations, they do it through a feminist and anti-racist approach. So lots of different things.
Awesome. And I apologize because I got sent the book just this week, and I've literally tried. I read the introduction over the weekend, so I'm poised to carry on reading the rest of the book. So this was really recent. So I guess the podcast and the book and your work kind of all collide. So how does the podcast then turn into this book, I guess, is the question.
So we were overawed to get all the people that we, you know, I mean, people that really mean something to us on the podcast. And we have a diverse range of interests. Kerry and I love to read. We are, you know, Kerry's been at Cambridge for 8 years, but she also has an enormous range of interests, including cooking and crocheting, music, etc. So we wanted to also invite on the podcasts artists, science fiction writers, and all sorts of people that are doing something cool in the AI ethics space. We get bored quite easily, so it's really nice to have that kind of interesting turnover of guests. And then we ask them what should be quite a simple question: what is good technology? And in fact, that question becomes more complicated, because good technology is not good everywhere. It's good in a particular context. For someone, it might mean their blood glucose monitor, but only when it's working well and has the cap on, not when it malfunctions. For the philosophers, it tends to be an opportunity to talk about, you know, what is good and for whom. So these larger, more abstract questions. So it's interesting to see how different people approach it. And there's a lot of love that resounds in the book. I think it's something that we don't have enough of in the world at the moment. People really love each other in the book, but also can disagree. And there's a sense of solidarity, but also of difference, both in the styles and approaches to the question of good technology. But overall, there's a sense of that's what Kerry and I, our contribution to the book is. It's bringing these people together, saying coalitions are really important. It's not just about individual voices. It's about how you edit them, how you bring them together, how you put them in conversation with one another.
I'm really interested in turning the tables on you guys. And I apologize if this is like, I'm hoping that you've gestated this idea for long enough. So what is good technology? And is it even possible?
I love that you're challenging us with our own questions, because I find it always really fascinating to hear people's responses to this question. And sometimes people really respond in quite a negative way to the questioning itself, because they'll say, well, this is creating a really unhealthy binary around good and bad, or like, is this even the right question to be asking, which is both incredibly important, but also is a wonderfully academic thing to ask. Are we asking the right questions? And someone who's been, you know, full-time in academia a long time, I definitely fall into those same kinds of patterns of thinking. But the more that I do this podcast, the more I become convinced that in the same way that there isn't one kind of bad or one kind of unhappiness. I think also there can be a multiplicity of goodness. And I think the only way we can maintain hope in this like very bleak world is to believe that what one person's good technology looks like might be different to another, but it doesn't mean necessarily that we can't have this multiplicity of good. And, you know, I know there's that very famous quote about, you know, every happy family is the same, but every unhappy family is unhappy in their own way. And I don't think that's actually true. I think happiness, goodness, like one of the main purposes of trying to explore all these different approaches to technology is recognizing that there is this plurality to them. So what do I think good technology is? I see good technology as something that in both the large things and the small things helps us live our lives more freely and more expansively, that pushes us towards a world without borders, a world without prisons, a world where we can live without fear. And, you know, I really think that there doesn't need to necessarily be a cap on how we imagine those technologies. And that doesn't mean that I don't think the technologies we use every day aren't very complicit. I love that scene in The Good Place. Sorry, this is a spoiler for anyone who's not seen The Good Place, but it's been out for quite a while now, so I feel fine, where they talk about how hard it is to live a good life now because the world has become so globalized and complex. Mm-hmm. And that's something I think about every single day when I use technology. But at the same time, I also hope that even within those complicities, we can find moments for resistance, find moments for joy, and find moments for what Luc de Noronha and Gracie Mae Bradley call non-reformist reforms. So making changes which aren't about affirming a system that is unjust, but ultimately is about trying to get us to a better place. So those are all quite abstract ideas. I know sometimes it can be quite hard when people talk in very abstract things. So I often use the example of something as simple as knitting needles as a good technology, something which is still, you know, not separated from the world that we live in and how capitalism exploits us, right? When we think about where yarn comes from or where wool comes from. But at the same time, the simple act of knitting for me feels quite magical, being able to create something with two sticks and a ball of string. So that's how I think about this question of good technology.
Wow, what a beautiful response. Well, we think a lot about what the negative sides of technologies are, and why, you know, good technology is never good for everyone, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the really important thing for me how I make my life livable and not too, you know, not too depressing is trying to retain the sense of enchantment that we have, even while we know technologies are all dual use. There can be a negative impact, whether it's I love this piece of software I use that I'm not funded by, but Descript is amazing for editing podcast transcripts. And there is a sense of magic and wonder that every time I delete a section of the text file, it deletes a corresponding section of the video. And to retain that kind of magic and wonder is really important for me, because I think that, you know, we can disenchant the world really easily. There's this idea that technology has deleted enchantment, has made has made mockery of magic. And this has all but disappeared. And actually, with the kind of return of the tarot card, that seems to be really having its moment right now in popular culture. And at events that I go to, there's always like a tarot card reader. And I think people are really kind of hunting for that. And I blame the Enlightenment, which was trying to produce this idea of progress devoid of spirituality and a sense of the unknowable. So that's a really important thing for me to retain. It doesn't mean that we're moving away from science. It just means that there is a way of interacting with technology that needs to be joyful, but considered. That doesn't mean that we should be naive and not realize that, okay, the editing software I'm using actually probably takes me more time, because now we don't have our editor anymore. So the labor impact of that is still very, very clear to me. So we need to do what, to stay with what one of my favorite philosophers, Rosie Braidotti, calls the headache of trying to think our reliance on technologies that we may hate, that we may disagree with, that have an ethical impact, but also take delight in. That is the reality of life, this kind of muddy mess. And we need to try and enjoy it in some way.
God, it is a mess though, isn't it? I think those are really great answers, so thank you. I think one of the things that really struck me, I guess there's two things I'd like to bring up with both of those things, which are, I guess, not rebuttals, but are things that I noticed. What you were saying, Kerry, is... it strikes me that it's very political and very kind of values led. And it's this kind of striving for a better situation, right? Not like, you know, putting a plaster over what we have, but actually trying to transition in a more meaningful way over here. And but that kind of presumes this idea of where we're going, right? And that is embedded with some values, which is, you know, a whole sticky situation. And I guess science fiction and or just fiction generally has a place in that, and as well as philosophy and academia. To be able to know where we're going is a useful thing, right? Like you pointed out, it'd be nice to have less borders, you know. But then how do you get there, and how does that work, and all that sort of thing, exploring that landscape. I actually believe deeply in that one as well. So I don't know. Do you find that this whole endeavor at the moment is just very political and very values led? And is that worrying? Because obviously values can be the moralistic values that people have do change and per culture or ideology and such.
Yes, no, absolutely. I think it is deeply political. And sometimes it's helpful just to lay that out and say we recognize that the work we do on the Good Robot podcast, the work we do and all of our incredible thinkers in the book do, is deeply political work and sees technology and politics as always being really intertwined. And this is something I definitely struggle with, which is, you know, on the one hand, I think it is a crucial role of feminist thinking around technology to try and imagine different kinds of futures. I get very worried about the rhetoric of us being locked into certain kinds of, quote, AI-powered futures. I get worried about who's propagating that rhetoric, largely big tech companies and national AI strategies. But at the same time, I'm also quite wary of leaving us, you know, in a kind of state where we're saying, okay, there's going to be this feminist progress narrative and things are always going to get better because we're always working towards this better world. And that's inevitably be going to come. Because unfortunately, I think we've seen a lot of ways in which there have been massive political and social transformations, which have been very positive. But we've also seen places where we haven't necessarily seen these promises fulfilled either. And so I was talking about this actually with Eleanor and with Sabine from Queer and AI. I was using immigration in my home country, Aotearoa, New Zealand, as an example, and talking about how my parents say that there was a generation of New Zealanders in, say, the 1950s and 60s that they felt was actually more pro-immigration than the generation that followed, in a kind of direct upsetting of this multiculturalist progress narrative. And they said, actually, I think that the post-war generation was more tolerant or more accepting of immigrants and wanted to see this vision of a multicultural society, whereas by the time the economic recessions hit in the 70s and 80s, you ended up with another generation of New Zealanders who very much positioned immigrants as a threat to their jobs and their economic livelihoods. But I remember at the time finding that quite challenging because I was a lot younger and I felt like, of course, things must be getting better for us. There are many more people in New Zealand who look like me. There are many more people with similar cultural backgrounds. And yet the way that we're portrayed or perceived or our role in that society maybe is still always in flux and changing. So I agree that we need to really be working to have an active hand on the steering wheel if we want those promises of political change to come true.
One of the key messages of feminist thought is that all knowledge is situated. And that means that it's always political. There's always a politics to the location, to the moment in time, to the context. And I think this can be scary for companies because they want to try to be apolitical as best as possible. And at some point, it's just worth saying, you know, this is our politics, because you're approach to AI ethics isn't about trying to make the technologies neutral, because that's impossible. What we need companies to be doing is just stating where they're at, and then it's up to the consumer to decide if that's the right company for them, or if that's the client that they want to be working with. There's a really nice paper that's really radical that I like, and it's on algorithmic reparations. And it takes the idea of reparations, which is still a source of lots of shouting in the UK and political shouting, often with my parents at home. And it tries to use that idea to explore why algorithms that do justice, that work against power, need to really be explicitly doing that. And that means trying, not seeking redemption for the past, but trying to work against some of the wrongs of the past by actively seeking good on behalf of the groups and demographics that had the worst time out of the way that power was distributed in society. And even just to say, okay, no, that's not what we want to do, and make that explicit, I think would be a movement in the right direction, rather than pretend that that's not really, that's not exactly how difficult it is, because those are the conversations that need to happen. It really needs to be that difficult and that explicit. Yeah,
awesome. I think the idea of just companies fessing up to being somewhat political, and this is a PR nightmare, right? But like being appreciating essentially their role in society and going, well, like we make stuff and stuff has an impact, and therefore, you know, we're changing the landscape, and that is a political act essentially. And just being mindful of those things would be a massive step forward. And being like responsible, accountable, that's it, accountable for these things, because then, because yeah, you can say all sorts of things, can't you?
Yes, yeah. And I think this is unfortunately something we've seen a lot with big tech companies, where there is a public rhetoric around AI safety, and then privately there is a lot of lobbying to water down regulation. I think OpenAI is probably one of the most famous examples here when it comes to, say, their behind the scenes lobbying with the EU AI Act, while at the same time Sam Altman was becoming a leading voice on AI ethics and AI safety on the global stage. At the same time, I think the point you've raised around companies having politics are interesting, not only in terms of the products they produce, but also increasingly as these companies start to act as political players. And this is something I work on with the AI Now Institute, a policy think tank in New York, which is drawing on the work of people like Swati Srivastava, for example, who puts forward this idea of hybrid sovereignty, or saying what kinds of political leadership and political action is emerging outside of the state, or the way that we might ordinarily think about politics. And when you look at the size of these companies, I think it becomes increasingly hard to deny that they are political actors. Even when we think about this in the most staid and traditional international relations way, which is through the lens of the state.
I also wanted to say, when I was at school, I didn't study politics, and I didn't really know what was the political realm and what wasn't. And also another key message of feminism is that politics is everywhere. You know, there's a politics to the domestic space, as there is to the way that we're taught things in school, to education. And, you know, well, we know certainly that there's a lack of accountability amongst our politicians, but do we connect that to the lack of accountability in big tech more broadly? So I would really love for this to be taught in schools, you know, the politics of the tech industry, of what Kerry just talked about, and how that impacts our kind of day-to-day life, which is also a political life.
So I don't know if this is mean, but I kind of wanted to go back to Eleanor, your response earlier to the original question of what is good technology, because I think, because I feel like, I'm just going to say I'm a realist and see what happens, but I think the magical spiritual stuff that you were referring to, I'm probably not saying this in a particularly useful light, it's both anti progress and the idea of there being a world which is finite, right? So these tech companies and capitalism rely on this kind of infinite growth, which doesn't really exist. So maybe the magical and kind of more spiritual realms are helping with this kind of fight that notion. But I also feel like, for me, as a not very particularly spiritual person and a very scientifically logical person, it sounds like something I don't want to engage with, basically. and something which is, you know, again, I think you brought it up, but it's like not anti progress or anti like learning and understanding, but it kind of feels like that to me, you know what I mean?
I'm so glad that you brought this up, because every time I see a Google engineer say that their system is sentient, I think what they're really doing is exploring the magic of it. They're sort of leaving the language of science behind and using the language of the humanities, of consciousness, of philosophy. So I really deeply see it in engineers. In fact, I see it more in the way that engineers interact with their systems. My mum did electrical engineering, and she was one of the first women to do round the world yacht racing competitively. She's now a dinosaur in her 70s. And she, when she tells me how things work, whether it's, you know, domestic appliances or bigger pieces of kit, there is a magic in her eyes, explaining something that is man-made. You know, she's literally in the process of the explanation. It gives me no magic to look at things and how they're put together. Really, my boyfriend also has studied engineering, and he loves to see how things work. I quite like understanding how things work. Partly because I was single for a long time, so it's very important to know how things work, because no one else is going to help you. But it doesn't instill me with the same sense of kind of magic and wonder and awe as a great book or a, you know, stuff that people who like literature enjoy. So I think what I'd really like to do is give a different language to the way that scientists are finding pleasure in their systems. I don't think, you know, we need to discuss consciousness in a way that's quite unscientific. I mean, let's be honest. The way that Googlers were talking about whether their systems were sentient is not sciencey. And there's lots of evidence to suggest that consciousness is not a singular phenomenon, but is the result of lots of non-conscious cognizers, so thinking things that come together to create what appears to be a single entity. And actually, this is a kind of, this is a myth that is grounded in very anthropocentric ideas about what consciousness is. So there's a point at which the scientist moves away from an explanation towards magic. And actually, I, maybe that's the twist to the story, want to re-inject some real science back into it.
Well, I mean, maybe that's, I mean, that it feels like ChatGPT and the large language models and things like that are magical in that formulation, because you ask it to do something, or you ask it, you know, to make prose, and it can, to a way that we appreciate and can read and can formulate our own kind of ideas in our head about what that is, you know, how that's touching us and how that feels as an embodied consciousness or whatever. So I guess the magic at that point is how we react to the stimulus, and you know, if we're talking about how us as beings relate to the world, you know, if it looks like a duck, it's a duck, right? You know, if it looks like it's a biological thing that does something, then, you know, we can relate to it in that way almost.
I think GPT is a perfect example, as is digital art. The people that know more about how it works actually experience more magic and wonder than the people who don't. Mm. So a lot of the, I mean, I don't really like digital art, but my friends who work in generative AI love it, partly because they understand the mechanics behind it. Mm. And that gives them, you know, a real sense of wonder. So, and this is what Einstein said. You know, he was a Christian. And he, the more he knew about the universe, the more awe-inspiring it was to him. So I think there's this very false assumption that the more we know, the less magic there is. But actually, mm-hmm. it can definitely be the other way around. Yeah. I hate the poems created by GPT because I love poetry. I've never met someone who was like, oh, I'm obsessed with Yeats and was just reciting poems to me, but also like love ChatGPT's poems.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got, I've actually got a hunch that a lot of human creativity is actually, and like value is derived from the stories we tell about the mediums and the people that make it and the authors and all this sort of stuff. So I feel like it's, I feel like there's a paper coming along here, but there's a story to be told in the creation of a product. And when there is a limited understanding or limited just creation process, and the outcome is not necessarily visceral, then I feel like it's difficult to relate to it. But it's weird because on the flip side, you do get generated music, which is visceral and hits you in a different way. So I'm trying to untangle this at the moment, but it's an interesting place, I think, creativity and AI anyway.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
So I know that we've talked about some of this already. So one of the other questions that you guys ask on the podcast, The Good Robot, is how can feminism help? And I guess what we're saying is, how can we help with creation of good technology? On this podcast, we talk about AI and algorithms and that sort of thing. So is there, from what we haven't already talked about, some other explicit ways that you see that your work and feminism generally can help?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this has been one of the most exciting movements in the field of AI ethics, very broadly speaking, which has been this really big movement towards understanding how other kinds of movements and activism and areas of research which have explored injustice and the way that that shapes the world can be and are extremely relevant to how we think about new technologies, that AI poses certain kinds of new problems, but often the problems that they pose are either replicating existing problems or entrenching other kinds of inequalities that we already see in the world. And so we can't really fully grapple with how these technologies might be changing our societies or transforming our relationship with technology without thinking about these other relations of power. And so for me, I see feminist thought and activism and histories as a really important way of rewriting not just the stories that we tell about AI, to draw on what you just previously said, Ben, but also to think about and what our pasts and presents have been with technology and what kinds of futures we want to have with them. And so one way that I think about this a lot is through the lens of Asian American feminisms and Asian diaspora feminisms, which have always interrogated the intersections of race, gender, and sex in terms of thinking about what it means to exist in a society that maybe has not been built for you, or a space that has not been necessarily hospitable to you, and what it means to rewrite both our human and our technological relations to be a more equitable and inclusive place. And sometimes that looks like technological fixes, but a lot of the times it looks like a lot more than that. It needs political fixes. So a lot of the work that I do specifically is thinking about how attributes like gender and race get represented in things like data sets. So I draw on a lot of the insights of things like mixed race studies, which looks at the experiences of people who have never quite fitted into a lot of the data categories that we have to say, okay, well, if we're scaling up and rolling out a lot of these AI systems, what does that mean for people for whom these categories have never really worked? And what does this say about the kinds of new data collection practices or new systems we might need to build if we actually want these technologies to work for everyone? Because often I think people are very, very well-meaning, but they might not necessarily, A, have grappled necessarily with these histories or understand the kind of meaning of these racial categorizations, or B, they might be under too much pressure to produce profit. They might be under too much pressure to get a result. And so they decide actually these populations are simply not statistically significant enough for us to change our method. We see this a lot with genderqueer people, with trans people as well, which is people who are who they say, okay, we recognize that people, these people have a different experience. They might need a different categorization, but we're under a time crunch. And so we're just going to leave that data to the side. And I'm not saying that addressing these problems is easy at all, but rather that with feminist and anti-racist thinking, we do have a long legacy of grappling with what does it mean to try and defend the rights of people who have been historically oppressed or who are minoritized, and how does it actually transform at both our tools and our societies into better places for everyone?
Pretty nice. I think to do something a bit different after Carrie's another very beautiful explanation. One of the things that I tried to do is take radical ideas from feminist theory and apply them to AI. So this doesn't mean, this is quite far removed from doing like a headcount of like how many women are there in the data set kind of thing. And one of the ideas that we tried that we're using quite effectively to show how AI works better than the way that people say that it does, is the idea of performativity. Now, it came from gender studies. It was an idea that was put forward by a number of different people, including Judith Butler, and then was used by a feminist physicist called Karen Barad, who's fantastic, who explored through Niels Bohr's experiments with wave particles, how the server in the experiment and the apparatus affects the observed world. So the way that you do the observation actually determines the results of the experiment. And this idea maps quite nicely onto what Judith Butler said about gender, that the gendered body does not pre-exist society, but is created through it. And that doesn't mean that there's a body that has society mapped onto it. It means that we materially emerge in a repeated process, not just throughout the day, but kind of, you know, throughout your lifetime, through the way that the body interacts with institutions, whether you know, what happens to you in jail as you move through life in the education system, et cetera. And this may seem a little complicated, but I'll explain it through a piece of software that was used by a company called Dataminer. And Dataminer started off as an event detection system used in the States to help journalists identify potential news events. And so you could create a map around an area. And then if there was loads of tweets in that area and images of fire and smoke, it was likely that there was a fire in that area. And then journalists could kind of target in on that story. And this seemed pretty innocuous. I actually met somebody a couple of days ago at Bloomberg who was working for the company, a journalist. And when they moved from working with journalists to working with governments and the police to help them track and monitor protests like Black Lives Matter. And it turns out that it wasn't just a single bit of software, as is the case. It was a bundle, a cluster, an assemblage of different kinds of systems, from machine vision to social media scraping. And these would come together to give the police information about, right, we're in Baltimore, there's a crowd gathering here, this is what's likely to happen. And what the technology was doing was sending an alert to the police. And that alert was saying, there's a potentially violent protest going on in this place. Now the machine was deciding what constitutes a potentially violent protest. What does it look like? Something that has not yet happened. And it was a kind of predictive policing based in the logic of the police. Right, there's a group of black and brown people holding signs saying defund the police. To you, the police, this is what a potentially violent protest looks like. And by creating this, this alert, by creating a lens through which the police viewed the world through their own politics and their own assumptions, they were creating the protest, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The protest, the violent protest doesn't pre-exist the technology's perception of it. And this is an example of how AI can be performative, how it actually produces the world that it claims to observe.
Yeah, I think it's really important because there's various examples of this as well, that, you know, where you, it's almost like, where are you going to apply technology where it could be beneficial, I guess, in this values-led landscape that we have, I've tried to discover earlier on. And where is it going to go this other way and be kind of dogmatic almost? I feel like dogma is my favorite word in AI because it's like, it's inherently dogmatic, right? You give it an AI, like, data set, and then it produces the outcome from the data set. So,
but interestingly, it comes to, like, religious dogma is the kind of dogma that I think about. And I think, you know, when we were talking earlier about exorcising religion and mysticism from science, but yet we get a lot of this language that does come from extremism.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, it can continue these things, you know, people have a lot of, there's a lot of talk about bias and the kinds of bias that we're introducing into these systems and things like that, because of, you know, how humans interact. And that is a form of, like, for me, it's like, it could be, you could form as religious dogma, but it's like, it's dogmatic, right? The bias towards a certain way of viewing the world, or going down a particular line in YouTube, for example, and being shown more things which are kind of reinforcing, again, is like one of those other very simple examples of how these systems actually shape, you know, our experience almost, and how we as individuals are placed in this environment, I guess, as you were saying before, kind of placed in this world on a constantly reconstituting it. So it's problematic. So I'm hoping that you guys have got all the answers and you can just sort it out for us. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Oh my God.
Yeah. So I really want to ask you the two questions that we always ask on the Machine Ethics Podcast, which one we usually ask at the beginning. So I'm going to ask for your brief answers, if that's okay. And then we'll move on to the second one, which is the ultimate question. So what is AI, essentially, for you? I know we talked about technologies and how they exist in the world. But more specifically, kind of how do you feel about AI and the ideas surrounding AI?
Sure. I mean, I think this is a great question. So very briefly, I think of artificial intelligence specifically above all as a concept rather than as any singular technology, because I think what the last few years have really shown us is the power of this idea and its mass application to a lot of technologies that 15 to 20 years ago, we wouldn't have called AI. So simple things like a decision tree now being called artificial intelligence. And to me, the point there is not to say we need to continually raise the bar of what we count as AI, but rather to interrogate, why does this idea hold so much power? Why are we so interested in it? And again, I don't come from a background in computer science, just to be clear. And I know that there are very specific kinds of techniques, things like machine learning, for example, which people increasingly call and associate with being artificial intelligence. But as a scholar of politics, as someone who's been thinking very, very deeply about the kinds of stories we tell about AI and why they matter, I think we can see this concept taking hold in really powerful ways. And it really shapes the kinds of technologies we see as being desirable and the kinds of technologies we see as being possible.
Such a lovely answer. Me too. I think that it's best to think about these things as an idea, so that you can go back to that stage and say, how should this idea be explored? And where does it make sense? And where does it not make sense? When we're building this online tool that helps companies meet the EU's obligations, and we focus a lot on that ideation stage. So the bit before you've even started to build an AI product, you sit there and think, right, who's this for? Who's on our team? Why are we building this? Is there evidence to suggest that AI would be useful in this domain? Is it tried and tested? Who have we consulted? And I think that stage is the most important one. But we forget that all things, whether it's shoes or combine harvesters, emerged as an idea. And the best products are ideas that responded to a particular need. I think with the great exception of Apple, which just creates needs. And I'm kind of more than willing to just tap in and buy additional stuff. So go back to this idea of like, you know, is this, it's not just like, oh, our clients tell us we need to start using AI. So we need to just use anything, but like, you know, is this the right thing for what we're trying to do? And I mean, I'm so unfortunately so disillusioned at the moment, because I go to company event after company event where they're like, we just need to be using AI in some form, and doesn't matter if it's real AI or just something that has AI kind of on a bit of the website, or, you know, there's a button that you press that switches on some like machine learning functionality, but it's not an integral or core part of the system. So we need to make AI unsexy again. It needs to be like another banal thing. Also so that some of the companies we work with who are lovely, who've been like, we've been using AI for ages. It's just the things that we're doing with it are not like super exciting. That's what we want, is to make AI boring again.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think there's so many things which are falling out the funnel almost. You know, we were talking about AI, I'm going to say 10 years ago, it's not 8 years ago, okay? And it's all image recognition and, you know, processing data in an interesting way with all sorts of different machine learning stuff, and then some deep learning. And now it's just kind of like LLMs. Is AI just LLMs now? When you know, you talk to people and it's like, oh yeah, I use AI, and you're like, yeah, but are you just talking about LLMs, like this specific subset of an architecture which is based on neural networks, which is probably distributed by this massive company? It doesn't smack of, you know, that's, for me, that's not what AI is, essentially. It's funny. But yeah, so I resonates with me that we need to make AI unsexy again. And you can make really small, interesting things with, you know, on your computer. So it doesn't have to be this massive thing.
It should be about play and experimentation. I don't know why. I think because AI does things at scale and very quickly, it's become associated with scale, but it's not, you know. And the large, it just sounds good. It's like the kind of big swinging dick thing of having the largest model, or the most data parameters or whatever. But a lot of the really cool people that do kind of speculative design in AI that Kerry and I work with think about local contextual systems. And this sounds quite like, you know, eco-friendly, sort of hippy-dippy. But actually, if you're sitting there at home making a system that works for you, that you trust, that's another great example of how AI can be local, as in it solves you, your local problem. And it's a bit like slapdash, and things kind of, you know, maybe a bit of bricolage, and maybe not the cleanest, most beautiful thing you've ever seen, but it works well for you. You trust it. You know what it does. You know its limitations. And those are the kinds of AI systems that we really need.
Bit of knitting.
Yeah, exactly.
So the last question is, given the AI mediated environment that we live in, what excites you and what scares you?
Yes, many, many things scare me as someone who looks at the dark and seedy underbelly of tech. most of the time. Some things excite me. I think to start with things that concern me or scare me, you know, I think that as someone who looks at the international politics of AI, the global extraction supply chains, the way that the expansion of digital infrastructures is reshaping world politics, you know, I think that it's absolutely crucial that we start to try and hold big tech companies to account, that we think about technological good not through the nationalistic lens of things like national AI strategies or national success, but rather start to see these technologies as something that, if we're serious about them being good, that that necessarily has to be a global good, not a localized sort of nationalistic one. And I'm also very, very concerned about the environmental impact of these technologies. It's something that I try to emphasize a lot when I talk, which is simply that if you care about being a conscious consumer of plastic, of other kinds of materials, then it's really important you also think about that in relation to technology. And I say that not in a way that, oh, I'm somehow perfect and that I am not complicit in this environmental damage. Of course I am. I'm talking to you on a computer right now, which I know is probably made through various kinds of resource extraction. But I think, you know, the more that I work in this area, the more intentional I become about framing these kinds of environmental extractions being part of these sets of global injustices that AI can entrench. So a favorite scholar of mine, Max LeBoyerin, has a book called Pollution is Colonialism. And in this book, they talk about the way that our relationship with the land and the planet is often fundamentally colonial, because we see it as able to withstand a certain amount of pollution or waste or extraction before we say, okay, well, now it's polluted. And that extractive relationship is itself the problem. So those are some of the things that really scare me, alongside some of the problems that we discuss in the book and elsewhere to do with how AI can entrench and exacerbate kinds of sexism and racism. I think the things that excite me, apart from, again, you know, the moments of wonderment I have in the kinds of technological play that Eleanor described earlier in this episode, is more the way that I see people galvanizing around these technologies and using the emergence of these technologies to ask these bigger value questions of what do we want from our societies and what do we want from each other. I'm not saying, again, that the emergence of these technologies is necessarily the best way that this could have happened. But at the same time, I think it's really interesting and positive to see these questions around what is art and why does it matter? You know, what, where do our products come from and why does this matter? And I think even though sometimes I can be very, very pessimistic about the tone of that debate, I was really encouraged to hear, for example, the way that the interest in the environmental impact of AI has massively taken off. They did a big series of street interviews, I think, in Taiwan. And this was one of the biggest flags that people raised, as they said, we're worried that these aren't eco-friendly tools. And I found that really encouraging, because I think 2 years ago, that was not really a huge public conversation. At the same time, I also want to avoid that progress narrative that we talked about a bit earlier, because I think this journey has necessarily been a little bit bumpy. So, for example, I was really encouraged in 2020 when we had these big movements around facial recognition in cities being used by police. We had very big agitation in the UK context around the use of the A-level algorithm, and people becoming more familiar with ideas like algorithmic injustice and algorithmic inequality. And I think, unfortunately, ChatGPT set us back, to me, several years in that critical debate. So I remember finding that moment particularly disappointing, because I think people really got sucked in to this huge, huge hype wave propagated by companies like OpenAI. Nonetheless, even with that, you know, caveat in mind of it's not necessarily a linear road, I think this moment of kind of societal reflection on what do these technologies tell us about our societies and ourselves is what makes me a bit excited or a bit hopeful.
I agree. I'm always excited by people asking questions. I think that's what life is all about. And I don't want it just to be the people who are hard done by, who are asking those questions. And that's sort of what we're seeing in big tech, that these amazing engineers like Timnit Gebru and Margaret Mitchell, who are supposed to be doing frontier tech work, asking big questions about and exploring their excitement, are instead being distracted by having to, you know, respond to things about ethics and culture issues in technology. And so really what I'd like to see is for everyone to be able to explore their excitement and not be held back by the barriers, the obstacles, and the things that are not going well, and having to ask also different sorts of questions. I would like people's politics and concerns about the world, and it doesn't matter what your demographic is, to also enter into your feelings and your desires around AI too. Excitement shouldn't be unfettered. It should be always tempered by your concerns and your understanding of the world. And I think that just makes excitement richer. I don't think that draws away from it. Naive excitement is not good for anyone. I'm excited by the rise of tech unions, by friends who are like, I had a super smart friend who did law at Oxford and is now a barrister and has moved into representing tech unions. And that to me is really cool because I think it signals something. And what it signals is just that we have better, more robust companies with workers who are like, yeah, I'm a scientist, but I'm also kind of, you know, invested in myself, thinking about the systems that I'm making and whether I believe in those systems. Like, you don't have to just be trying to get from A to B to do science. You can also locate science in politics and in a particular kind of knowledge and really think critically. I want critically thinking scientists, but also people from the humanities that know more about STEM. I think we need to go and do like take your friend to work day, exactly, where you go and visit your friend in their place of work and get to know more about what we're thinking and just be kinder to each other. I'm excited about people gaining knowledge.
Awesome, thank you. And that's a lovely place to leave. So thank you both for your time, your energy, your positivity. How can people find out about you both and what you do?
Harry.
Well, you can hear us on the Good Robot Podcast. You can find our latest book in bookstores, online at bloomsbury.com, also on Amazon, speaking of complicity with big tech. And then, yes, you can also find us on the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence website, and you can follow us both on Twitter, LinkedIn, and we also have a Good Robot TikTok and Instagram.
What's the book called, Kerry?
It's called The Good Robot, Why Technology Needs Feminism.
Great, and it's short essays, it's really easy to read, and it's a perfect entrance into top thinkers around technology, and I promise I've edited it within an inch of its life, so it's very readable. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Bye, pleasure.
Hi, and welcome to the end of the episode. Thanks again to Eleanor and Kerry. I think some of the things that really resonated with me from that episode were this idea of technology being inherently political and that we shouldn't shy away from that. Maybe we could call that out. Maybe we could be a little bit more transparent about our own values and capacities and all this sort of thing. And although I wasn't totally sold on the magical nature of technologies, I think Eleanor had a really good point about the performative nature and the way that we react to technology and the unknown, the unknowable, the way that things look and feel organic, or they make you viscerally react in certain ways and things like that, as extension of this magicality. I'm just going to make up that word now. I found that really interesting as a point as well. So thank you to them. Also, check out the podcast, and hopefully I will be on their show very soon, so check that out. And until next time, thanks very much for listening.